successful, but we equally well know that there are some things which are not explained by it, like dark matter, dark energy, and so we have to go beyond our standard model. On the other hand, we have string theory, which has a rich structure and many possibilities, and we would have to ask this question, whether we can connect the two things. So the question we are going to ask is, well, the question would be, can we learn something from string theory for particle physics, or even more modest, can we incorporate particle physics models within the framework of string theory? There has been recent progress in this, and one of them is explicit model building towards the MSSM being the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. And here there is this notion of the heterotic plane world, and also what we call local grand unification. Earlier in this meeting, you heard a talk by Kumon Wafa, who was talking about some F-theory picture, which has recently come up, very recently come up, and I will comment on that at the appropriate place. Another progress has been made in the question of moduli stabilization and the question of supersymmetry breakdown, because this construction we have done here in a certain way starts in a supersymmetric situation. You have to break supersymmetry, and then you have to see what are, in a certain way, the predictions or the pattern of the supersymmetry breakdown, the soft masses which you can get in such a scheme. Now, since this is a mixed audience, in some way, I would explain you in a nutshell what the situation in particle physics is. We have the standard model. And so what we have is a gauge group for strong, weak, and electromagnetic interaction, which is based on this gauge group SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And we have three families of quarks and leptons, and we also say that we have a scalar Higgs doublet, which has not been found yet, but for particle physics, it seems that this is granted that such a thing exists. In any case, we need this one in the standard model. But there might be more. And there are these reasons like dark matter, which tell us that this cannot be complete. And there are also some other interesting indications that there might be something more above and beyond the standard model. One of them is supersymmetry. So this standard model should be extended to a supersymmetric model. And the other one is also that there are neutrino masses, or the neutrino mass spectrum seems to tell us that there is something going on at higher energies, and this runs in some way under the name of the seesaw mechanism. And there is a hint for a large mass scale around 10 to the 16 GeV above the scale of the standard model where new things might appear. This indirect evidence is not just that there's a scale at 10 to the 16, but also a new scale at the TeV scale, and the TeV scale would be the supersymmetric scale. As I said, one of them is the neutrino oscillation in the seesaw mechanism. There one thinks one has a right-handed neutrino at a large scale, and the low energy, the left-handed neutrino, the Majorana mass of the left-handed neutrino would then come as mw squared over mgut. And if you plug in mw squared and mu as measured, something like 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, then you will get to an mgut scale, which is around 10 to the 16, 10 to the 15 GeV. Of course, this is an order of magnitude estimate. And the other even stronger evidence is evolution, the measured or the computed evolution of the coupling constants of the standard model when you go to higher energies. If we have the standard model and we know all the particles, we know the gauge coupling constants, then we can actually follow them to high energies. And if nothing else would happen, we can see what would be the ultimate fate of the evolution of the coupling constant. Now, in a supersymmetric model, since it has a different number of particles, this matches perfectly. And I actually show you here the picture as it was measured in 1990, and this is actually as it was given in the CERN Korea as a picture. And you have to contract that to the standard model, where the picture rather looks like this. So the standard model, this evolution of the coupling constant, is not really pointing towards one point, whereas in the supersymmetric model, it does. And that is now, in a certain way, giving us these two scales. We have to put new stuff at the TV scale so that we change the evolution in such a way that the coupling constants meet at the large scale. So this is one of the motivations to do supersymmetric beyond the usual theoretical ones, which have to do with stability in the ultraviolet quadratic divergences, hierarchy problem, etc. Now, this leads us now again to a grand unified picture within the framework of supersymmetry. And this is actually very nice, because when we look at a family of quarks and leptons, including the right-handed neutrino, it fits in one representation of a gauge group, the Spinor representation of SO10, which is 16-dimensional. So this is beautiful. You see, the family looks pretty complicated, but here in SO10, it looks simple. And so you can have unified multiplets. You can say, I have three families of quarks and leptons, and they are all in a 16-dimensional representation of SO10. It leads to gauge coupling unification, as we have seen, and it will also lead to Yukawa unification. You could actually relate, for example, the top quark Yukawa coupling to the gauge coupling, and you get a consistent picture. It also favors a neutrino seesaw mechanism, so this is very nice. Now, you all know grand unified theories are beautiful, but there are a few things which are not so easy. And there remain a few difficulties, and one of them is the breakdown of the grand unified group to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And there, typically, things start to be cumbersome. You need large representation, 210-dimension representation, 126-dimension representation, and that's something which people start thinking that's not the most economical way of doing it. There's also a problem with a complete Higgs multiplet, because if we would be in SO10 and we say we need a Higgs doublet, a second doublet, then we would have to introduce a 10-dimensional representation of SO10, which would not only have an SU2 doublet, but also an SU3 triplet. And these triplets we do not want, first of all, because they change the evolution of the coupling constant. Second, they lead to proton decay. So they have to be very heavy. So we actually have a situation where some of the representations, like the family of quarks and leptons, where they are supposed to be in a complete multiplet, whereas we think that the Higgs should be in a split multiplet. So it should not be complete. There should be something missing. And that's something which runs usually under the doublet triplet splitting problem in the usual grand unified picture. The other thing which has also worry about is that when we do a supersymmetric theory, we actually cannot any longer distinguish between a Higgs and a lepton, because they are supersymmetric multiplets. And therefore, we need something to distinguish, because otherwise we would have rapid proton decay. And that's actually the need for R parity. So we need some symmetry which lets us distinguish between the Higgs and the leptons. And that symmetry, actually, we have to impose. So at first, this looks pretty bad. But then, of course, it pays off later, because it actually means that the theory which we are considering has a stable particle. And that stable particle, as you know, and as you've heard several times during this conference, is actually a rather good candidate for dark matter in the universe, as we see it now. So this is the picture of grand unification. So that's, in a certain way, the status. Now let's see what the string theory gives us. So from string theory, certainly we get supersymmetry. So the 10-dimensional, the theory, when we try to construct it, is supposed to be supersymmetric. It gives us extra spatial dimensions. So these theories typically live in 10 and 11 dimensions. It also gives us large unified gauge groups. For example, in the heterotic string, we have SO32 gauge group, or E8 times E8 gauge groups. They are very large. And in addition, string theory will tackle the problem of gravity, which we have not yet attacked in the standard model. So we might get restrictions in model building just because of that. So string theory essentially contains everything which we need, maybe even more. But we do not know whether these things fit together. And the basic problem which we have in this case is that the beautiful string theory is constructed in higher dimensions, like 10 dimensions. We live in 4 dimensions, and we have to understand how we get from 10 to 4 dimensions. And that's the process of compactification of extra spatial dimensions. 6 spatial dimensions should be compactified. And the typical picture, how that looks like, is the following one. You say you compactify it on a Calabi-Yau manifold, and these are complicated objects constructed mathematically. And this is a picture of a two-dimensional section of such a Calabi-Yau manifold. And it is beautifully colored, and see, it looks very nice. But you also see that it has a lot of structure. It has certain places where the curvature is much bigger than in other places. It might even have holes and all these kind of things. So that makes it very complicated to work on there. So one has to make some approximation. And an approximation, for example, would be that you replace such an object by what is known as an orbifold, which in a certain way is a torus which you fold. The advantage of this one is that the sides are always flat when you look at them, and all the curvature is concentrated at certain points. Now, this might look stupid if you look at this beautiful theory of a Calabi-Yau manifold. You might say that this is too simple. But one can see that actually such a simple picture encodes very much, very many of the actual qualitative properties of the Calabi-Yau. And the main point is that we'll see that we have these localized points where essentially all the curvature is sitting, and these are special points, and that could actually be points where particles are sitting. So we have a question, we have this notion of localization of states in the extra spatial dimensions. And this localization, as we will see, will be very important for the discussion in the following. So we have that all. Before, now we'll talk about the localization. So we are thinking about the quarks, the leptons, and the Higgs fields, so what usually you call the matter fields. They have three choices in this picture. They can either be spread all over that manifold, or they can live on three points, which would be points in this extra dimensions, or they could live on five points, which mean that they can live on two. They can live freely on a surface in this extra six-dimensional, so a two-cycle in this extra six-dimensional space. So, and the physics and the properties of the model depends where the fields live. But that's not all. There's also a localization of the gauge field. So, for example, when we take the heterotic string, the 8 cross the 8, then typically in the bulk we have a large gauge symmetry. But on the various planes at these various points, we have broken the symmetry down to a smaller one. And in fact, the observed four-dimensional gauge group will be a common subgroup of that gauge group. And that will also mean that this gauge group, this unification is not everywhere. It has to do with certain properties at isolated points which are distant from each other. And the gauge group will be broken to various pieces there, but when you put the things together, you will get a much smaller gauge group. And I actually wanted to give you here a situation which can happen in that case. So there are certain points where the gauge symmetry is indicated here. So here you have SO10. That means if here the electron sits here, the full first family has to sit there because it has to fill a complete representation of the gauge group. So that is up and down quarks would also sit here, and we, made out of up, down quarks and electrons, essentially would actually live on that point. That's where we would sit in the extra dimension. But of course, there could be fields sitting here. They would come in SU6 cross SU2 representations, and here in SU4 squared. And this looks all rather strange, big gauge groups. And you say, what does that have to do with the real world? But as I said to you, the gauge group in four dimensions is the gauge group which is common to all of these gauge groups. So you have to look how these things overlap and what is actually the outcome of this. You actually look at it, you get the standard model gauge group. For example, here, you see this SO10 and this SU6 cross SU2, they have a common gauge group SU5, the same true here. But you see, even here, these two groups, they have a common gauge group, which is SR4 cross SU2 squared, so they are not aligned along each other. This has SU4 squared, there's an SU3 here, there's SU3, and if you knew all the dust settles and you do a group theory, the common gauge group in four dimensions is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. In four dimensions, there's no unification whatsoever. The unification happens exclusively at these various special points, especially this one. And that actually means that you can have complete multiplets if somebody sits here, but if fields live at other points or even can live in the bulk, they do not have filled SO10 representations. So in terms of the Higgs, one should say the Higgs should not be at such a point because we want to have a split multiplet. So this is the picture. And that is what we call local grand unification. You can have complete multiplets for the Fermat families, and we can have split multiplets for the gauge bosons and the Higgs bosons, because also the gauge bosons in four dimensions will just be the 12 gauge bosons of the standard model. We also can get partial Yukawa unification, mb over m tau, if the third family sits at one of the fixed points. So this is the picture. So the key properties actually depend, of the model, depend on the geography of the fields in extra dimension. And we call this scheme local guts, because they are locally sitting at a fixed point. You don't have this global gut picture, and they can actually be realized in heterotic string theory. So we could then have remnants of SO10, like the full, the complete multiplets, but we can have, it's completely broken in D equal to 4, the gauge multiplet is split, and we can have the coexistence of complete and incomplete multiplets, and there could be remnants. Like, you could have a complete family, including the Yukawa coupling relation. You have the correct hypercharge normalization. You have R parity. And you can have a distinction between different families, because one family might live on an SO10 point, whereas others do not live there. So this is very useful for realistic model building. So this is actually the point where, in some way, we would say this is the bottom-up picture. We could now go and say, I put a family here, I put a family there. And then I have a model which does what I want. And that's in a certain way, at the moment, the situation which we had heard in the F-theory picture. You have this bottom-up approach, you make some assumptions, and then you tell what could be go on. The next step after that to do is actually whether you can realize that explicitly in string theory models. And that's not so easy. So there has been some work done over the years in trying to actually find string vacua, which you see give you this picture in a nice form, and maybe even give you correlations so that you can learn something about it. And the most successful work in that direction is in a certain specific orbifold, which is named as the Z62 orbifold, which means that you do some Z6 rotation of the torus. So this here should indicate the free two-dimensional parts of the torus, which are twisted in a certain way. And so this actually, this set 2-6 twist, I cannot explain that now. It provides fixed points and fixed tori. So we have fields which live on tori in the extra dimensions. We have fields which live on fixed points in the extra dimension. And we have fields which live in the bulk of the extra dimension. It allows for an SO10 gauge group. And actually, you can have localized, even two families of them localized at a given fixed point. So you can, either one or two families you can put there, and you will have a complete multiplet. And you know, when you have this sitting at a certain point, you also have to buy the relations. And of course, these gut relations for some of the families are not so good. So you want some families to be there, others not. SO10. That's technically is broken via Wilson line. This comes from this twisting. And one also has a non-trivial hidden sector gauge group to break supersymmetry. Those are something will I come in a moment. So we now started to construct such models. And we started first with selecting certain shifts, which give us SO10. And typically here, we had two choices of doing it, getting SO10. And we got some 22,000, some 30,000 models in total. When we now reduce this to the standard model gauge group models, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, and we actually demand that this is a subgroup of SO10 that's completely inside. This boils down to something like 5,000 models. And then we have to ask the question, how many of these models have three families? We cannot choose that here. Some models have one family or four families or others. And here we actually see that this is so a third of these models gets down to three families. We then demand gauge coupling unification, get the right sine squared theta w. Again, this reduces the number by a factor of 2. And we also demand that there are no particles which are beyond the standard model. So no chiral exotics, no other stuff which in some way would only become massive if SU2 cross U1 breaks down. And that's actually a big restriction. And that actually kills most of the models in other approaches as well, that in this last section step, you actually see that a lot of models go. Still, in this picture here, we are pretty successful compared to other approaches because we have something like 200 models which we can then study in detail. They have been studied now in the last year or so from this. They give us local grand unification. They give us gauge and partial Yukawa unification, has been demonstrated. Also, we have examples of the neutrino seesaw mechanism. There have been some claims that this is impossible within that approach. And in addition, there are models with R parity and a solution to the mu problem. So this is something which, because of lack of time, I will not discuss here. I will concentrate on something which has to do with supersymmetry breakdown. And we actually have, as I said before, we have a hidden sector, and we can actually have Gaugino condensation in the hidden sector to break supersymmetry. So we have a hidden sector gauge group, and in this lambda cubed, we have a gauge, lambda is the renormalization group invariant scale. We see in these models what we get, and if we would have the correct coupling constant with that lambda, we'd actually get a supersymmetry breaking down at the scale of TEV. So that works very well. But so we could understand why this is the small scale, but the problem we have to answer here is the problem that we have to discuss stabilization of the moduli. In this model yet, the gauge coupling constant has not been fixed yet, so the dilaton has been fixed by a mechanism. And we also have to worry about the adjustment of the vacuum. Recent progress has been made in this moduli stabilization, first in the type 2 string theory, but then also in the heterotic theory. And the idea is that there are fluxes, and these fluxes, together with Gaugino condensation, they can lead to a stabilization of the fluxes. Here in the model we have here, we would start with a runaway potential, but then we could, by fluxes, corrections to the Kähler potential, et cetera, we could, in a certain way, adjust the vacuum energy and also get a supersymmetry breakdown and stabilize the dilaton. And that would go in such a picture that we have a stabilized vacuum, which is Minkowski or slightly de Sitter, whatever you prefer as a vacuum energy. The question is whether such a scheme has some special structure. We have fluxes and we have Gaugino condensation. And here we see that when we are looking at the superpotential, there's a contribution from the flux and the Gaugino condensate. Let's say X is the dilaton, then the Gaugino condensate is e to the minus X. So something in W should be small in order to have a small supersymmetry breakdown scale, and X is moderately large. So from that point of view, if something is small, X has to be moderately large, and actually X is the logarithm of M Planck over M3 half. M Planck, the Planck scale, M3 half, the supersymmetry, the gravitino mass scale. So we have something which is the logarithm of the hierarchy. Now, since the hierarchy is very big, the logarithm of the hierarchy is moderately big. In fact, numerically, X is 4 pi squared in order when you put in these numbers. And that actually means, in this scheme, that the dominant contribution from supersymmetry breakdown to the soft terms is actually suppressed by this factor of 1 over 4 pi squared. And by that fact, it will compete with other contributions which come from loop contributions, which are also suppressed by 1 over 4 pi squared. And for reasons that will be explained later, I call this scheme mirage mediation. It has this problem that the moduli and the gravitino are rather heavy, and that, as we will see in a moment, the Gaugino mass spectrum is compressed. So we get something which is known as mirage unification of Gaugino masses. This comes in the following way. When you have this usual picture, and we have the gauge coupling unification at 10 to the 16 GeV, I started at 43, now 35 minutes. Okay. Good. In any case, now what you see is when you have these contributions from these radiative corrections, they will in a certain way induce a non-universality at the large scale. But this non-universality is in fact given in the simple case by the beta function. The running also goes via the beta function, and that means that in a certain that they meet again at a certain scale. They will actually have a situation that they meet at a certain scale, and that's a kind of intermediate scale in this case, but this scale could move depending how much this is split. So you will actually see that Gaugino masses meet at a scale where there's no new physics. That's why we call this mirage unification. Actually, the mirage picture is pretty successful. It has two parameters. It has the relation, it has the Gravitino mass and this relation of the two contributions. And you see this is a picture how in such a scheme, so this white region is allowed, and actually you can even accommodate in some way the abundance of the neutralino in a way that it fits. So there are some important messages here. First of all, this mechanism of adjusting the cosmological constant is very important. And at a second step, Gaugino masses predictions are rather robust. And a third, that the dilaton modulus mediation is suppressed. So we can actually now look what that means when we look at the LHC. Now, the LHC is a machine which scatters gluons and gluons. So in some way, it will be, if supersymmetry is there and light enough, it will be a gluino factory. And the gluino then will cascade, and we will learn a lot about these particles. Now, let us now assume that the low energy particle content of the MSSM is exactly that what it is, and we assume the measured values of the gauge coupling. And the gauge couplings are 1 to 2 to 6. This is how they are measured. When we run them up, then they meet at the gut scale. We also observe that the evolution of the Gaugino masses goes in the same way as the gauge coupling constant. So MA over GA squared does not run. It stays constant, at least at one loop. So for this discussion here, that's enough. So this implies in somewhat robust predictions for the Gaugino masses. You see, once we know them at low energies, we can actually learn a lot about the high energy theory, at least when we are lucky. So, and therefore, I think that the key, the Gaugino masses will be the key issue to reveal the underlying scheme, at least in the first few years of LHC, before we get into more detailed things. Now we can actually look what we get. We can identify three simple patterns. One is the M-Suka pattern. This is universal Gaugino masses at the gut scale. And that, of course, means that M1 to M2 to M3 is 1 to 2 to 6, like the gauge coupling constant, because they have been unified. This would mean that M1, the Bino, is the lightest, the candidate for the lightest neutralino. And it would mean that the gluino to Bino ratio is 6. So if you would produce a gluino, let's cascade it down, be able to measure the mass of the lightest supersymmetric particle, and it comes out 6, this would be great, because that would be the supersymmetric pattern where everybody is interested. There's another pattern, which is the anomaly pattern, which is the one where you have these radiative corrections which go with the beta function of the low of the standard model. There, actually, when you take the values at the large scale, you run them down, you will get a pattern which is not 1 to 2 to 6 for the Gaugino masses, but it will be 3.3 to 1 to 9. So here, the LSP actually will not be M1, but rather M2. So we will have the Vino to be the LSP. And the gluino to the Vino, the LSP mass ratio will be 9. So it will be even bigger. Now, the anomaly scheme in itself has some problems, but we are here only discussing the Gaugino. The third one is a kind of mirage pattern, which is somewhere in between. For example, when you have a parameter relation between these two contributions, which is 5, which I did not explain here. So depending where this scale is, you can move the scale. You can move them to an intermediate scale, as you saw in the picture. Then the ratio is 1 to 1.3 to 2.5. Or even if you move it down to the TeV scale, the Gaugino masses will be equal. So in this case, again, we will have the LSP to be predominantly Bino. But the gluino to Bino ratio will be much smaller, could be much smaller than 6. So it would have, in a certain way, a compressed pattern of these masses. So that, in a certain way, are simple patterns which we can expect, which are rather robust in model building, and where we can, in fact, infer something. So let me now conclude. I hope I have conveyed you that there are some possibilities that we can get new ideas from particle physics for model building. And I have concentrated on this concept of the local grand unification, which gives us all the good grand unified picture and avoids the bad. And there's also this question of mirage unification, which seems to be rather generic. And as we have seen, the geography of the fields in the extra dimensions is very important for deducing these parameters, the localization of the fields of the brain, and also this presence of the sequestered sector, which lead to supersymmetry breakdown. And LAC, and given the next talk, maybe even the Tevatron, might help us in some way to verify some of these ideas. Thank you very much.
Okay, questions? Yeah, Maxon.
Like the operators like that?
Well, you see, the first step which we tried to incorporate in this model was just to get an R parity, and that we succeeded. We could also have some more symmetries like a set 6 parity, which would forbid the dimension 5 operators. We have not done that yet. But in any case, work is in progress. This is not yet solved. It's the top-down approach is much more easy than the bottom-up approach, where you can assume that these things work. Yeah, yeah.
One other quick question, if there is one. Oh, down here.
Maybe the previous speaker asked this question. The bête noire of grand unification is the fact that the proton doesn't decay. And also, how do you explain the smallness of the cosmological constant?
Well, you see, the first question, of course, is that, you see, grand unification has this possibility of giving proton decay, but I think in the framework of the supersymmetric model, since we have raised the grand unified scale compared to the non-supersymmetric models, you can go beyond the present experimental limits of 10 to the 34 years. And secondly, I think I had, maybe I said that not clearly enough, in these models, this cosmological constant had been fine-tuned with an additional sector, which I call the uplifting sector. So there was explicitly a fine-tuning of the cosmological constant within the given scheme I discussed here. I didn't address that problem.
Let's thank Hans-Peter again.